Hello and welcome to the next episode of the Complete Physio podcast. I'm very excited to do this podcast. Simon's cancelled on me about two or three times. So finally we've got together and we're here with Mr. Simon Owen Johnson, who I worked out this morning. I've known for about 14 years.
It is
a long time. And Simon is an upper limb surgeon. And today the podcast is all about frozen shoulder. We've chosen frozen shoulder because we've shared lots of patients that have had frozen shoulder, and it is probably the most common, certainly I think it's the most common condition I see.
I think so. I see two or three a week, every week.
Yeah, perfect. So if you're sitting at home and you've got a frozen shoulder, or you think you may have a frozen shoulder, then hopefully this information will be really useful to getting you on the right treatment pathway. So first of all, Simon, some stats. This amazes me every time. 2 to 3% of the population get a frozen shoulder
at some point in their life. Yes.
That's like 3 out of 100 people.
It's massive.
Yeah. Imagine Wembley Stadium, say it takes 100,000, like 3,000 people would have a frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
And we know it's more in women than men, although it definitely happens in men. And then diabetics, that can go up to 20%.
Yeah.
That's
about right.
It's astonishing, yeah. Really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing.
So let's first of all start with the simple question, what is a frozen shoulder?
So in terms of what it is, I suppose you could consider it from the patient's point of view, it hurts like stink.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. Patients notice that it hurts. And it hurts when they sleep. It hurts on sudden movements. And it hurts when they try and do normal stuff. And it's ridiculously painful. And people often say that they feel like they're going to faint or be sick if they, you know, if they're holding the underground and the train jolts, or they forget and they throw a ball to the dog,
yeah,
or they roll onto that sort of thing. So that's the first thing they notice, is that it's really, really painful. Then sometimes they notice stiffness. And people say things like, I can't put underarm on, or I can't tuck a shirt in, or I can't reach a place here, or it's painful when I'm trying to put my jacket on. Those are the things. And there are some sort of niche sporting things. The climbers sometimes say, I can't reach here. Those are the things that the patients notice, pain and stiffness. The pathological things are entirely different things. So on imaging, we see a normal x-ray. We often see a normal MRI scan. And on an ultrasound, you might see a bit of fluid in the joint. You might see a little bit of fluid around the biceps groove. You might see a little bit of increased blood flow on the Doppler. But often you see nothing very much. It doesn't leave much trail.
So how do you diagnose it then?
It's a clinical thing, effectively. So a patient gives a characteristic history. So 2/3 of patients with a frozen shoulder will say, I fell off my skis in the winter, mountain bike in the summer, fell down the stairs in Ibiza, wrenched my shoulder, some such thing. Another 1/3 of them have no history of trauma of any kind. And I think probably amongst those who attribute, there's a possible bias. They blame something like, so we had the window open or that kind of, you know, dodgy tomato. Or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But so there's some have a history of trauma, some have nothing. I've lost my thought. Where were we going?
Yeah, and then I think the last 1/3 will be those patients, because you do see it after operation, don't you?
Yeah.
Slightly different beats, but you do see people after that. So I'll pick up on a couple of things already that you've mentioned. So The first thing is how painful frozen shoulder is. And I actually interviewed 15 people for a master's dissertation. So I interviewed 15 people with frozen shoulder, and I was astonished how, you know, women were comparing it to childbirth. You know, so this is really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think where people sometimes struggle is, as you just said, the imaging is not that, you know, there's not that much obvious non-imaging.
Confirmation.
And you can't see anything from the outside. So there's no bruising. It's not swollen because you can't see shoulder swelling. And obviously, if you break your arm, you might. But so there's not a lot to show why you're in so much pain. I think that is one of the reasons a lot of people with frozen shoulder do get a bit fobbed off and don't get a lot of sympathy by health professionals and by, you know, friends, peers, you know, wives, husbands.
If you just take history, everyone says, oh, it's a little bit painful, it's a little bit stiff. And if you don't examine them, you won't see quite how stiff and quite how painful it is.
So the second thing that I was going to pick up, so pain number one, they all say, I can't sleep at night. Yeah. Or once it's developed into, you know, like a full-blown frozen shoulder. So we talked about the pain, and the other thing is about diagnosis. So the MRI doesn't show that much, right, et cetera. So can you just show us specifically how you would, because I'm sure there's people at home thinking, well, I'm not getting better. I've got pain at night. Maybe I've got a frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
How would you assess that?
So I go, tenderness, there's usually nothing to see. So the first thing, always I tell the GPs, take the patient's shirt up. You've got to see skin to see what's moving. Sometimes you see muscular wasting that's been present a long time. You won't see anything, you just see it on the outside on the skin. You don't usually find much tenderness, although sometimes in that subcoracoid area, it's a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But then the hallmark is a global restriction of range of movement.
Yeah.
So I get them to do forward flexion,
yeah,
abduction, internal rotation, bra strap position, external rotation, T-tray position.
Yeah.
And they'll be restricted in all of those.
Yeah.
We've got two sides. There'll be a difference in every single range of movement. Yeah. There'll be a difference.
It's not hard to diagnose.
It's not rocket science.
No. When you see a lot of it, I had one yesterday.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take long at all, but it is being missed regularly. Yeah. And I think it's because for a healthcare professional, be it a GP, be it a physio, be it an orthopedic consultant, whoever, to fully assess whether somebody has a frozen shoulder, they've got to take their time,
yeah,
to actually see, yeah, the way that they move. And, yeah, I think particularly in GP world, when they've got 6 minutes,
there isn't time.
They don't have the time to fully assess, get them lying on the bed and see what we're doing. So one of the key things with the frozen shoulder, as you said there, is the restriction in movement. But the key thing is that it's restricted for the patient, but it's also restricted for you, yeah, moving it. So you just want to talk a bit more about
that. So that's the difference between active and passive range,
yeah,
isn't it? So an active range of movement is what the patient can do, can get to there. And if they had some injury to the motors, the tendons or the muscle, I might be able to take the joint further.
Hmm.
But in the frozen shoulder, they can use all of the range they've got and the range is stiff. So passively, they're restricted. They can't go and nobody can get them.
Yeah, because some people might come in and say, I can't move my shoulder, but when you come, yeah, along and get them lying down,
yeah,
they've got movement. So it's not, yeah, frozen,
no,
then, is it?
No.
So then it might be a tendon, it might be a rotator cuff problem or something else. Okay, so the diagnosis is quite straightforward.
I think so. It's mostly clinical. So it'll be a typical history of, fell off something, wasn't too bad on the day, got worse over the subsequent few days to few weeks, and now I can't tuck my shirt in, yep, put my underarm on, and it wakes me at night, and I'm terrified of throwing the dog, yep, those kind of things. The examination will show passive range restriction, but within those ranges, it's a fairly normal shoulder. So as long as you don't get to the end of range,
yep,
they've got plenty of power. Sometimes I find that the subscap test is positive. Belly press,
yes,
test gives pain.
Yes.
I've never read in a book anywhere. It's Owen Johnston.
So that's when they squeeze onto, yeah, their stomach,
you,
and it causes,
you try and fight them and it's painful.
Yeah, yeah. But sometimes everything's painful, isn't it?
Everything's painful.
And so it's quite non-specific. Yeah. I see lots of patients, like the lady I saw yesterday, I feel is quite classic, where she was doing something in the gym, didn't really, she felt like her shoulder moved a bit in an awkward position, but was fine for about 5 days.
Yeah.
And then she started to say, well, actually I'm starting to feel a bit more pain.
Yeah.
And the key thing is it doesn't get better.
It's just unrelenting, isn't it?
Or gets,
it's just,
it gets worse.
Tighter and tighter.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So 3 months down the line, she's like, well, this should be better by now, but actually I'm worse. I'm now waking up at night.
Yeah.
That's quite a classic, yeah, sort of frozen shoulder. So we talked about it a little bit in the beginning. So who does typically get frozen shoulder? Who do you see it in?
Well, I have a sort of slightly skewed practice because I'm here in the City of London. Mm. So I see people between 40 and 60, but that is the main target. Yeah. But I have seen people of 70 with a frozen shoulder, where I've seen people of 30 odd with a frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
But they're the extremes of the thing. The bulk of it is that 40 to 60.
Yeah. And I heard somebody say once, if somebody's under 40, like it could be a frozen shoulder, but, yeah, you've got to rule out
something else.
And over 60, obviously, you are getting into arthritic territory there, yeah, and it might be, yeah, something else. But most of the time, it's like a bell shape. They, yeah, all fit into that sort of category.
It's yellow and walks like a duck.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think the ends of the thing, the extremes of that bell shape curve, they're the ones we should investigate a little bit further. So if someone's 70, and I think it's probably a frozen shoulder, well, as you say, it might not be a frozen shoulder. It might be arthritis. So they need an x-ray.
Yeah.
If someone's 30 with a stiff, painful shoulder, it might not be a frozen shoulder. It might be a tumor. It might,
yeah,
be something peculiar.
Yeah.
They need an x-ray or a scan.
Yeah.
And a scan.
And that was going to be my next question, is if somebody is sitting at home thinking, I've got a frozen shoulder, what should they do? Because they will be sitting going, well, nobody knows what's wrong. Surely I need an X-ray or I need an MRI. But that's not what we're saying this.
No, is it? I think for most people, it's an obvious clinical diagnosis. You come to someone like us who does it all day. Yeah. You go, that's a frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
Because we're familiar with it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And it does have a pattern, but it is straightforward.
It is straightforward.
And the other thing I think sometimes happens is, and for people that are watching it, 2 months ago, if you saw your GP, it might not have been a frozen shoulder. Yeah. They might have just said, well, it's a bit of a tendon, but actually it needs to be reassessed because the pattern has changed.
Because a simple injury, by and large, ought to get better. Most things do. Nature's good.
They do.
Most things get better, don't they? And so if something isn't getting better, that's the time to think about whether you should really investigate it further. Yeah. Just to pick up on something you said before, sometimes people say, it happened when I was reaching behind the seat in the car.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not that. That's when they first discovered it.
Yeah. So that's as a gym.
That's not caused them. It's the same at the gym, isn't it? They're not always caused in the gym.
No.
That's where they first realize that the thing is different pattern.
Yeah. And we always, as humans, try and put a cause to an effect. But actually, with frozen shoulder, and this is the next thing, what causes it? Like, what do we actually know about it?
Next question, Your Honor.
Yeah.
We don't know. There have been lots and lots of candidates. There are some associations. It's associated with diabetes, which is associated with Dupuytren's contracture. It's the same pathology down a microscope. It's fibrotic scar tissue.
Yeah.
We know. So there's a genetic element to it. Some people are probably predisposed to it. And there's a crossover. So if you had one frozen shoulder, you've got a 15% likelihood over 5 years of getting on the other side.
Bit depressing, isn't it?
If you've had a frozen shoulder.
But equally, so I tell
people, say that.
If you had one and your other side starts to play up, it probably is frozen. Don't wait 3 months.
I get this question. What's the chance of getting a frozen shoulder again on the same shoulder?
According to Andy Carr, who's a professor in Oxford, zero.
Yeah.
So Andy wrote, who about 15 years ago now, 300 frozen shoulder patients, and no one had had two frozen.
Do you think you've come across one?
Don't think so.
No.
I think people have been wrongly diagnosed
in the first place. Yeah.
And also, if somebody says to me, well, I've had frozen shoulder on that before, I'll say to them, well, how long did it take to get better? And they say, oh, it was better in 3 weeks. And I'm like, well, you didn't have
probably
a frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
Which links into the next thing. So what is the natural path of a frozen shoulder? Because the first thing people do when you tell them you've got a frozen shoulder, is they're going to Google it.
Mm.
And it can be quite depressing, can't it?
It is depressing because the natural history is long and tedious.
Yeah.
So it's a three-phase thing, isn't it? There's a six-month phase of painful stiffness, and that's the horrible phase. That's when you can't sleep and everything's miserable. And then at around about 6 months, and in my experience, it's fairly accurately 6 months. There's a range, but it does seem to be 6 months. The pain drops out of it quite a bit. The shoulder stays as stiff, but the pain drops down and therefore the function increases, the disability decreases.
Yeah.
But that phase is a year and a half long.
Yeah.
Roughly.
Yeah.
And then at 2 years, then you're into the what they call the thawing phase.
Yes.
Which is another, think of a number, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, anything.
Yeah.
And long term, if you leave a frozen shoulder, a patient will get back roughly 80% of their range of movement.
They can be left with a bit of residual stiffness.
So, Andy's paper showed this, that if you look at them critically, you'll find a deficit. But they say, well, there's nothing wrong. It's perfectly okay because they've assimilated to their restriction.
And functionally, they're fine. They're back to doing everything they want to be able to do.
Yeah, completely.
So you've talked about the different phases, and most people do start, obviously, at the beginning with the stage one. And that's generally when we see them because they're, quite frankly, in agony.
Desperate.
They're desperate. So how do you treat these people?
Well, so usual thing, history, examination, imaging if it's appropriate. And then I tell them about that natural history.
Yeah.
It's like all of these things in healthcare, there's some choices. So they have a choice. So one option would be to wait for whatever length of time it's going to be for it to go away. And it will go away eventually.
But likely to be years.
Likely to be 4 or 5 years.
Yes, really. You might be out of that first painful stage.
6 months. Yeah, something like that. So if they can weather it, they could just wait and it will go away. So that's the first thing. Have an option to wait. Then the next thing is the restriction and the pain. Well, so the pain, tablets, injections. Steroid is magic for the pain of a frozen shoulder. So an intra-articular steroid injection is fantastic. It'll buy you, by the patient, typically 2 months' worth of pain relief. So that buys them sleep. And so they'll go for that in a big way. And the risks are minimal. Yeah. So it's a very, very tiny non-zero number of adverse
reactions. Yeah.
So effectively, it's essentially safe.
Yeah.
So I think steroid is brilliant. And physiotherapy.
Yeah.
So if you try and do physio without steroid, it's usually very painful. And neither the physio nor the patient likes it. It's cruel. They both...
Yeah.
I offer you can try it, but frankly, I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
If you just have the injection and don't do the physio, it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Because 2 months later, you'll be in the same place. So the combination of physio and an injection is my go-to frozen shoulder. And then there's a tiny number who are so stiff.
More diabetics?
Yes, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So they're so stiff, or they've had a distension, an injection and steroid, and they've done physio, and they're still tight, and they're still struggling. And for them, there's a surgical option.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So let's break some of that down. So the first thing you talked about was sort of painkillers, anti-inflammatories. Mm. From your vast experience, do you find that that does do it for some people?
No.
That's what I was going to say. No, but it's natural to try, isn't it? But it often still wakes them up at night.
Nobody wants an injection.
No, no.
It's not, I mean, it's, you know, it's no. It's not pleasant having an injection.
No.
But it's, you know, it's a bit like the COVID vaccine. It's a lifesaver.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good thing.
Yeah.
So I think, and also, frozen shoulder is so painful when you reach that bumper that you need something strong. But then you end up doped up all day long. Yeah. And of course, my city population can't do their work. And it's not nice. And especially constipated and drowsy and foggy, it's not a pleasant...
There's a lot of side effects to sort of the tablets, isn't there?
Good drugs are dirty. That's the problem.
Yeah. And so we pick up on physio, because a lot of people will go, well, let me try some physio first. But as a physio, it doesn't work.
You can't get to them.
No, because it's too painful.
It's too sore.
Yeah, and they're often sore after. And during the session, you can normally make a bit of a change, but it just doesn't last.
Doesn't carry over.
And actually, certainly the group I see for the injections, so I've tried a few sessions of physio and it's actually making it worse.
I think
more painful.
Sometimes in that first 6 months, the physio can sort of almost inflame it.
Yeah,
it's like fanning embers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Makes it worse.
Yeah. And then sometimes the stage one, it just settles down and there's for no reason.
Yeah.
And people will try things like acupuncture, hot packs, mobilization. But if it was me, and I'm biased because I do the injections, but I would not wait. I can say that because I know that's what I would not wait to get that injection because I believe, and I'd be interested in what you think of that, but if you think you've got a frozen shoulder, if it was me, I would want steroid in there as soon as possible. Obviously, it needs to be a reasoned conversation around the pros and the cons, but there's no doubt that if you can get some steroid in there to reduce the inflammation, potentially you could help reduce how long this whole thing hangs around for.
You'll certainly reduce the disability of it. Mm. Now, where the steroid changes the natural history of the condition is debatable, and it probably doesn't. But it mitigates the pain that facilitates physio. And the physio and the stretching increases the function, drops the disability.
Yeah.
So I regard steroid as the great facilitator of the improvement in function.
Yeah.
It's not a fix.
I do 100 a year.
Yeah.
And if people say to me, is this going to work? And I always say, look, generally speaking, this is like my standard lines. Generally speaking, steroid is a really effective injection for frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
However, there's no guarantees that it helps. And probably on one hand, I can actually think of people that it's aggravated. Yeah. And I don't know why, because it's certainly not the technical side of it.
Yeah.
Do you have any inclinations?
No, I don't.
The diabetics obviously don't respond so well.
Respond less well. And the diabetes messes with everything, including frozen shoulder. So their frozen shoulders are usually tighter, more painful, less responsive to anything we try.
And we're assuming that's because obviously the capsule is more fibrotic, more inflamed. It's a different collagen.
Yeah, they don't look any different surgically.
Do they not?
No, it all just looks like thick collagen.
Yeah, yeah.
Angry shoulder and thick scar tissue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so the idea of the injection is to get you from stage one to stage two, settle you down. And I will often say to people, as a minimum, this should give you a good night's sleep.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable.
Yeah.
And quite often you find that patients come back, I see them usually about 3 weeks after a steroid injection. So just, we should talk about the natural history.
Yeah.
Bit unpleasant on the day, a bit tweaky, like a vaccine. will typically give a flare for a couple of days, takes about a week to work, and then settles in and works, I think, for about 2 months. So the books say, you know, 2 to 6 months. My experience is it's 2 months exactly. Anything more than that, I think, is a bonus. And so, what's my train of thought? So when people have had an injection and I review them at around about 3 weeks, they've gone through that latent lag phase. The injection should be working at full tilt. And quite often they say, it's marvelous, it's magic. And I assess them objectively and their range of movement's no different.
So their pain's magically gone down, but they're still stiff.
Still stiff.
Yeah.
But they're delighted with it.
Yeah, because the pain's gone. And that's really all that everybody cares about, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So another question that we get asked by patients, how many injections can you or should you have? Do you have a certain number in mind, or do you just do one and see how you get on? What's your thoughts around number of injections?
So I think the bad phase we've got to cover is 6 months long.
Yeah.
So I think whether in the second phase and it's just if you can do physio and they don't suffer so much. So we really only got to cover a 6 month period. And if steroid works for 2 months, then actually the most they're ever going to need is 3 injections.
Yes.
But often because of humanity, it'll take them a couple of months to get to us.
Yeah.
So we've usually only got somewhere between 2 and 4 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
So 1 to 2 injections will cover it. Yeah. So I tell them, you know, depending on where they are along the evolution, and you can't always tell where the start date is either. Yeah, they act on insidiously. This will give you 2 months worth. At the end of that 2 months, you're either going to be okay, in which case you're in the second phase, mission accomplished, or you're going to fall off a cliff.
Yeah.
In which case, let me know and I'll give another injection.
Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely it's definitely a condition, because we're going into the joint, we're not going into a tendon or near a tendon. I suppose questionable with the near the tendon, but in theory, you're going into a joint, so it's a closed capsule, so it's not just going everywhere.
Yeah.
So it is the type of injection we're normally comfortable to do more than one with, aren't we? Compared to, say, around tendons and
I'm happy with it. There are all, I mean, there are risks with injections, inevitably. You know, there's long risk, the risks include a long list of risks, faction, steroid atrophy of the tendons, bone density issues, all those kind of things. But we have to balance, as we always do, those risks against the risk of the frozen shoulder and the disability it caused.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's part of the consent and discussion about you want us.
And we would, we're both advocates that if you're going to go into a shoulder joint, that injection needs to be done ideally under ultrasound guidance.
Yeah, I mean, I've never done those without guidance.
No.
They probably were done, you know, 30 years ago before ultrasound was widespread. I've seen hundreds of these things. You can put the needle precisely in the right place.
Yeah.
Without, sorry, which is what I would have to do, finding my way in, walking into the joint. You can see that it's in very slowly and put the drug in.
Yeah, and I certainly see quite a few patients, because some GPs, some orthopedic surgeons will still do an unguided injection.
Yeah.
Certainly the GPs do. And then I see them and they go, well, I've had an injection, it didn't work. But because it's not an easy injection to do without guidance, I would definitely be happy, if I was happy with the diagnosis, to do a second injection. And I often find the guided version of that injection using ultrasound to guide the needle helps significantly.
I mean, I put a telescope into a joint, you know, every week without guidance. Yeah. And I've got my landmark, so like it's a blunt tip thing and I can feel it and I can feel where I'm going and then I can go in.
Yeah.
But when you've got a sharp needle, you don't get that same feedback.
No.
So the needle will go into anything.
Yeah, and it won't just slide up into the joint.
It doesn't find its way. It's not blunt tip. So you can stick a needle into the tendon, into the cartilage, into the joint, into the labrum, into the glenoid, and it will all feel about the same unless you're walking back with it. So I think an unguided injection is
relative. Certainly for shoulders. So we've talked about a steroid injection, which is normally a combination of a steroid injection, steroid and local anesthetic. Obviously, we'll do it with that. Now, there is another term that people may have come across, which is a hydrodistension or hydrodilatation, which is a type of injection technique, again, that needs to be done under ultrasound guidance. Can you just explain what that is and when you would favor one over the other?
Potentially? Well, that's a high volume injection. And that's the sort of standard go-to now for a steroid injection. For frozen shoulder, it is a large volume. The volume required is unknown.
Yep.
The Elbow and Shoulder Society did a survey recently about whether we should be going to capsular rupture or whether we should be keeping it all in.
Yeah.
Some of my colleagues will go for 20 mils because it's comfortable, a little bit of stretch. Some of them will go for capsular rupture, which was probably a slightly older technique now.
Yeah, it is.
And in fact, if you go back 30 years, hydrodistension alone without steroid was a recognized technique.
Yeah.
Just to stretch the capsule. But all our data now is for this paired thing of a steroid and high volume.
Yeah.
And there's remarkably little science separating out the effects of the two.
Yeah, definitely.
So my wife had a frozen shoulder.
All right, yeah.
Pair of it, in fact.
Yeah.
And I was sent to the literature to find out what the answer was to that is,
of course.
And I could find one paper, a Malaysian paper, that separated the effects of distension from steroids. And unfortunately, they used slightly different technique for both, so there was a confounding issue.
Yeah.
But they did find a slight improvement in the efficacy with distension.
With distension.
At 3 months, but not at 6 months.
And the distension is, and we use saline, don't we? Yeah. So we just put a load of saline, basically clean water, into the joint to try and stretch the capsule from the inside.
Logically, it doesn't make a lot of sense because the frozen shoulder is tightest at the front. It's what we see surgically. The capsule is thick. It's sometimes a centimeter thick at the front and it's thinner at the back.
Yeah.
If you then inflate that, it's going to blow out of the back where there's the loose pathology.
Yeah.
So from first principles, distension doesn't make a lot of sense.
Now, and as a surgeon, and this is in my head, I definitely get some sort of temporary increase in volume, but I can't picture that it's actually, because I've seen surgery and you have to really cut this capsule.
It's thick stuff.
Yeah.
You either do it with an electric device or some people do it with a scissor still, but it's hard. It's like shoe leather. It really is tough.
And then the key thing is, once you've had an injection, I would, you know, depending on how they respond, you want to start your physio. In some cases, I get people to start straight away.
And you start straight away.
But some people do get this flare,
and
I think you need to let that settle down before you.
I asked someone one day when they started physio, another physio, and he said, "Well, just follow the pain."
Yeah, exactly.
As it goes.
Yeah.
So some people get response straight away; they're ready to start straight away. Some people it's going to take a week. Just feel your way with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the most important thing is not to wait a fortnight or a month.
No,
because you're missing the opportunity.
Yeah, and you need to. If it starts, that's exactly what I would say. It's like, well, if it starts to feel better, go with it. Trying to get your movement back as well. Now, let's talk about surgery now, because there is, as you said, there is a subgroup, maybe more diabetics, but certainly people with very severe frozen shoulder. And it's only ever going to be the ones that haven't responded to an injection, I assume, or a couple of injections. Yeah. And I remember, like, when we met many years back, surgeons definitely did more capsular releases or manipulations under anesthetic, but we've definitely gone away a bit from that. Do you want to just talk about where the role for surgery is at the moment?
I suppose there are two operations. One is the old-fashioned thing, manipulation under anesthetic, or mauling under anoxia, one of our colleagues.
Oh, really?
And that is literally doing all the physio with the patient asleep in 3 seconds.
So you put the patient to sleep, and then you sort of just... Yikes, the armor.
Tear the capsule.
Sure.
So there's an acronym for FEAR. So you do flexion, external rotation, abduction. Sorry, I'll start that again. So FEAR. Flexion. I've not done one such a long time.
We're not editing.
Extension.
Yeah.
Abduction.
Yeah.
And external rotation, FEAR.
That's a reflection of how few surgeries you do on frozen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's to try and create a controlled tear, which then follows this way.
Do you feel it tear?
And you can hear it tear.
Oh.
You at least just hate it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's
pretty barbaric. Could you not damage a shoulder doing that?
So what you can do is fracture the humerus.
Right, we don't want that.
It's based on the idea that the bone is stronger than the capsule, which is a fair assumption in someone of 40, but not of someone of 70 necessarily.
Right,
yeah. 60. And so there is an incidence of fracture with it. It's also causing an uncontrolled tear. It causes a lot of bleeding, and you can't really quite see what you're doing.
Did it work?
It does work. And unfortunately, the data for this somewhat antiquated process shows it's as good as the more elegant solution, which is an arthroscopic capsular release.
Isn't it? Oh, talk to us about that.
Yeah, then. So that's a much more sophisticated way of doing it. It feels safer empirically. You put a camera into the joint, the back, a little lick at the front 6 millimeter hole, put an electric cutting device, which literally obliterates tissue, and then do a 360-degree cut around the socket. And that disconnects the tight capsule from the socket. It's a bit like...
But you're not like tearing the capsule. You're not slitting the capsule.
Taking it off, disconnecting one end.
Right, yeah.
So it does the same as a manipulation, but it does it in a controlled fashion. You can see exactly where you're cutting.
But you see, just I don't fully understand that. So you've got the capsule, like the sock around the joint.
Yeah.
So you don't cut the capsule.
So the capsule goes between the ball and the socket.
Yeah.
And it's got some named ligaments, which are thickenings of it. The superior, middle, and inferior glenohumeral ligaments, mostly at the front. And so you literally run this electric knife around the back of the socket to disconnect it, to make it, instead of being a tie bar that binds everything together, to make it into a separate sock. It's a bit like unplugging a seatbelt and leaving the seatbelt across your lap.
Right. It's there. So it loosens it off. Definitely. Yeah. Okay. And does that work?
It's a great operation when the patient's asleep. But of course, the capsule's still there generating some pain. It's still inflamed. Whatever the driving process is that we don't understand still exists. And the muscles are still tight.
And do you ever put steroid in?
Yeah. I didn't used to, but I've started
doing it.
Seems
like a sensible thing
because
to do.
It helps with the post-op pain.
Yeah.
And my feeling is it's beneficial.
And you're doing a steroid there.
I can see it's going in up.
Yeah. Afterwards. And so do you do many?
Yeah, one a month, something like that.
Yeah, which is still enough. And you'd always go for the capsule release over the manipulation.
So I did some approach. And she got a mild one side and a stiff the other side. And did a keyhole on the bad side and a manipulation on
while she was asleep. Which seems very sensible.
And she was much happier with the keyhole operation on the bad side. So I kind of, it's a case here, it's a one, obviously, but it's an operation that worries me. It's uncontrolled. It wasn't as good. Why don't I just stick to it?
Yes. And I'm assuming this is a very patient driven, isn't it? So what I mean by that is you present the options and they will decide, well, I don't want to live with this as it is, or I'm quite, or actually, do you know what? I'm fine. I'm just going to ride it out now.
Yeah. There's never a need to do that operation.
Yeah.
It's a patient choice.
Okay.
It's a bit frustrating because on the table, I will get 180, 90. And they wake up, and my experience is they get roughly halfway between where they start and the normal shoulder. So I think it gives them globally, broadly, a 50% improvement.
Yeah.
So it's a bit frustrating.
But functionally, that can be hugely beneficial, can't it?
Yeah.
It's funny, whenever I look at the operation notes of like how much movement you've got under general anesthetic, and then I feel them a week later, and I'm like, hang on.
Yeah.
But also, it does cause trauma, the surgery as well, doesn't it? So there is a risk. Is there a risk it could get tighter if you don't move it enough after?
Yeah, because all I'm doing is disconnecting the capsule.
Yeah.
And nature wants it to stick back on.
Yeah.
So that's where they've got to get going straight away.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I think we've covered most things there. So I think the key points for me would be the first thing is to get a good diagnosis and don't think that you have to have fancy imaging to get that. That's something that we can do very, very it's quick, isn't it?
Yeah.
On the odd occasion, though, there may be where it doesn't quite fit and you want to get some imaging, particularly under 40 and over 60s. It's a bloody painful condition.
Horrible.
That you probably don't get a lot of sympathy for.
Nope.
You don't sleep at night, which makes everybody miserable.
Yep.
I would be terrible to live with. And we know that an injection is definitely worth you exploring.
Yeah.
And then getting the information to make an informed decision. And maybe a couple of injections if you've responded well.
I think that's right. I mean, the general perception that frozen shoulder, when I was at medical school 30 years ago now, was that nothing can be done. You've just got to wait 2 years. It'll be horrible. And I think the most important message from modern healthcare is actually there are some things that can be done.
And injection therapies have progressed, haven't they, in that way?
And none of these treatments are perfect, but they're certainly better than just waiting years and years and years.
And although they can be around for a long period of time, our experience is once people are through the pain, they generally cope quite well with it.
That's right.
Yeah. That's right. Perfect. Thank you very much, Simon.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chris.
No problem.